different direction. We're going Kabbalah. We're going Madonna tonight. This is very exciting. So, the problem that we run into, and Yona, my husband and I were talking about this today, that when we're very excited about a topic, we'll put a lot of text on a page, and nobody else is really as excited. So I'm going to try to stay off the page for a minute, okay? Let's talk about, does anybody know anything about reincarnation? It could be anything in Judaism, in Greek thought, in Hindu thought, anything. Anything, anything. Yes, Shelley.
Well, just like the most basic thing is that if like you haven't completed something in this life, then in the next life you get another chance.
Great. Who here believes in reincarnation? Beth? Rachel? Great. Good. Good. There you go. A little admission here. Who here vehemently does not believe in reincarnation? Okay. It's just good to see who has what leanings in the room. But, okay. Great. So it's you have some unfinished business. Okay? Anything else? Yes, Paul? Yeah, you can come back as anything. Great. Yes, what's your name? Sorry?
I was saying, no, Judaism does not believe in reincarnation because the neshama goes after birth, right? But we don't believe that we, our neshama goes into an animal or another.
Right, so get ready for a wild ride because in Kabbalah they do believe it.
Oh, Kabbalah.
Yes, so that's where we're headed. Yes.
Well, the aim is not to have to come back. The aim is to do your tikkun while you're here. Then you're really born with God. But actually, I think this comes all out of Appia Ari, and that's, he was a very profound thinker, and it's become part of the Zohar, and it's I think, deeply steeped in Jewish thought.
Great. So we're going to look at Lurianic Kabbalah, Rabbi Isaac Luria in Sfat in the 16th century. So we'll get to that. Great. Let's get started. The origins of reincarnation, the very first place that we see reincarnation mentioned in any Western culture, I'm going to say, is in ancient Greece. If you look at number one, the conviction that the soul both leaves the body at death and passes into another body can only be securely attributed to Pythagoras, 6th century before the Common Era, but it was Plato who gave definitive shape to the idea of reincarnation as a punishment. Originally, the way Pythagoras puts it, reincarnation is just a natural part of life, life cycle, the world is made of cycles, which we're going to see in Hindu thought a little bit later, and human beings are a part of that. It has nothing to do with punishment or reward, it's just natural, that's the way the world works. But Plato said, no, no, it's a punishment. At death, the soul goes to the underworld to face judgment for its past life. Recompense is meted out either solely in the underworld or also by a new incarnation. Life in the body is inimical to the soul and something from which it desires to be released. So the element that is very important in terms of Greek reincarnation, well, two elements that are important in terms of Greek reincarnation is, one, it's a punishment, okay? It's not a good thing to be reincarnated. It's not the resurrection that we look at. It's a bad thing to be reincarnated. It means there's some unfinished business, as Shalom said. And the second is that it posits a very distinct schism between the mind and the body, between the soul, really, and the body. That this world is a place where we don't want to be, and where the soul can live as a pristine, alone, pure entity, that's where we do want to be. Okay? That is uniquely Greek, and Christianity took a lot of that, actually. Where do we see the first Jewish perspective on reincarnation? In Josephus. Very different from the Greek perspective. Josephus, as many people may know, was a general in the Jewish army in the first century. He was captured by the Romans, and he then was promoted by them and became a historian for them. So one of the books that he wrote about the Jewish war, in number two, he talks about the Pharisees, the Prushim, who are the ancestors of Chazal, right, who are the ancestors of rabbinic Judaism, oral law, as opposed to the Sadducees, who didn't believe in oral law. They just looked at the text and took it literally. He says that they believe that good souls are allotted the most holy place in heaven, whence in the revolution of the ages they return to find in chaste bodies a new habitation. Now, while some people like to claim that he's talking about reincarnation here, many people say, what do you mean? It's only the good souls who are being reincarnated. This is resurrection. He's talking about Tchiyat HaMetim. But that is where some people find the first mention in Jewish sources of something that sounds like reincarnation, even though we might view it more as resurrection, and certainly isn't a negative. But more importantly, before we get to the Kabbalistic things, I want to kind of see just how pervasive, just how significant this argument between the Kabbalists or the pro-reincarnation people and the anti-reincarnation people was. I want to see how much did Kabbalah really pervade Jewish society, and you're going to be shocked. Let's shock you. Let's start with number five, okay? Number five, Rabbi Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, right? You know, 16th century, he used to have visions. And in these visions, someone named the Mishnah, someone who we call the Mishnah, would come to him and speak to him. And in one of those visions, he wrote down these visions in something called Magid Meisharim. So in one of those visions, this is what the Mishnah said. When you die, the Rambam will come out to meet you because you have defended his decisions. And even now, he pleads on your behalf. It's pretty good so far. And he is among the saints, not as those sages who say that he has been reincarnated, etc. Meaning, the Rambam is a good guy. He wasn't reincarnated because he had unfinished business. Don't worry, he's in heaven pleading for you now. Now, this term, etc., in Hebrew is v'gomer, okay? Which also bears etymological similarity to the word for worm in Hebrew. So some people read this as Rav Yosef Karo's Mishnah was saying that the Rambam, according to many, had been reincarnated as a worm. Yeah, the Rambam would not have liked this at all. Right? So, for let it be that so it was decreed because of certain heretical views expressed by the Torah he had studied, should say, but the Torah that he had studied protected him. Meaning, even if the Rambam was heretical in his views, and he should have been reincarnated, his Torah study and his good deeds protected him. So he was not reincarnated, etc., or perhaps as a worm. But he was reincarnated, and then he died, and now he is among the saints. Okay? Rav Yosef Karo. Let's go back. Number three. Already in the 10th century, Rav Sadia Gaon. Last week I mentioned that Rav Sadia Gaon was the 8th century. He actually was the 10th century. I was confusing him with someone. So we're bringing him back for more. And he says in his book, Emunot V'Deot, Beliefs and Opinions, he says, Aval Omar, he starts talking, I mean, this is pages and pages. We'll just take a little excerpt. Aval Omar, I'm going to say the following. She'anashim mimisha nikra'im yudim. That there are some people who consider themselves Jews. In yano itzlam. And they think, basically, I'm paraphrasing, she'ruach re'uvein tashuv el Shimon. Reuven's soul can go into Shimon. V'achar kein b'levi. And then afterwards it can go into Levi's body. V'achar kein b'Yehuda, and go all the way down through Yaakov's sons. Right? He doesn't literally mean Reuven, Shimon, Levi, and Yehuda. He's just, you know, John Doe. Yesh pa'amim she'tiyeh ruach adam v'vehimah. And not only that, but as Paul says, there are times when a person's soul may go into an animal's body. V'ruach ha'vehimah v'adam. Sometimes an animal's soul can go into a person's body. U'dvarim rabim mizeh ha'shiga'on v'ha'irguv. And many crazy things like that, they believe. And I looked into what they thought, what brought them to think that reincarnation could happen, that this could be. And he determines, he says, the reason is, they have seen many traits in people, and they have found those traits to be domot midot habeimot. They found those traits to be similar to animals' traits. Kimi sharoim oto anav, for example, someone who is humble, it's sheepish. It's like a sheep. So you can be reincarnated as a sheep. Vira kimidat hachayot. And someone who's evil or wicked might be like a wild animal. Vira avtan kikelev. And someone who's excessively ravenous is like a dog. Vikal ka'ov, someone who's very fast, very swift, is like a bird. Vahadomel azeh. And things like this. Vihiskimu babur ela inyanim. And they agree because of these things. She'ela hamidot lo hayu b'vnei adam, that actually these traits didn't originate with humanity. Ad she'aya behem meruach meruchot habehimot. Actually, they originated with animals, and animal souls went into human souls, and now human souls can go into animal souls. That's what he suggests, and he clearly is not a fan of this. Okay? 10th century, pre what we call Kabbalah. There were clearly people walking around with all kinds of ideas. One more, the Rashba in 13th century Spain, which we're going to talk about, that was a center of Kabbalah. The Rashba in 13th century Spain also writes a responsa against the Kabbalists who believe in reincarnation. And he says one of the big problems is it causes a problem with Tchiyat HaMitim, with resurrection. How could it be that, you know, sitting in this very room, or not this very room, but let's say Zev and Zev's great-grandfather and perhaps Bina's great-grandmother all had the same soul. So what happens when they're resurrected? They're all going to fight over that one soul? Right? So these people are thinking, by the way, Bina, Zev. Zev, Bina. You apparently have some very close relationship way back when. But as you can see, people were taking this very seriously. Something I didn't even include on the sheet is a great tshuva from the Mahar Bach, which is 15th century Spain, and he says that you have to believe in Tchiyat HaMitim. It is a fundamental Jewish principle, and you can't go to Olam Haba without it. So this was taken quite seriously. On the other side of the coin, I want to show some very normative mepharshim who we look to for guidance, who used Kabbalah and specifically reincarnation in their commentaries. Yes? Reincarnation. Oh, did I misspeak? Reincarnation. Yes.
He comes out that the Rambam was not reincarnated?
It's not clear. It sounds like people thought that the Rambam was reincarnated and was still in his reincarnated state, and the Mishnah seemed to have told, meaning the Mishnah seemed to have told Rav Yosef Karo that the Rambam had been reincarnated once, but he had died again, and now he was in heaven.
But I think Rav Karo himself felt that he was a reincarnation himself with a woman's soul, actually.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. There are some very interesting books, if anybody's interested in reading sort of myths or stories about reincarnation. There were many rabbis, not just Rav Yosef Karo, but Rav Yosef Karo is certainly a very significant person, especially because he becomes a normative philosophist for us, but who really believed that they were reincarnations. Specifically, it was interesting when men thought they were reincarnations of women. You didn't get too much of the reverse, but you certainly got situations of men thinking they were reincarnations of women. But suffice to say, let's do two more things before we take a closer look at the Kabbalistic perspective. I see some very puzzled faces in the room. You should be puzzled. This is weird. Okay? I'm not disrespecting Kabbalists or reincarnation, but it is strange for a 21st century American Jew, modern Orthodox Jew, to think about the concept of reincarnation as a tenet of Jewish faith. It is strange. It would not have been strange for someone who is 16th century Israeli living in Tzfat. That would not have been strange for them, and it might not be strange for a 21st century Israeli living in Tzfat either. But we'll get there. Ramban. The Ramban, when he talks about Yibum, the mitzvah of Yibum, levirate marriage, is... I heard somebody say, a good one. Somebody said, it's a good one. We could probably still have that. Right. So the mitzvah is a biblical mitzvah. The mitzvah is basically the husband dies, they have no kids, the brother-in-law marries the widow. Right? Why did the brother-in-law marry the widow? So the Torah says to carry on the name of the deceased. So the Ramban says, Aval ha'inyan sod gadol, number 6, he says, this is actually a great secret. Misodot ha'torah b'toldat ha'adam. That this is a great secret among the secrets about the life of a human being. And even the ancient sages, Kodem HaTorah, before the Torah was given, like in Bereshit, where they try to do a form of Yibum with Yehuda's daughter-in-law, Tamar, right? Yodim, they knew Ki Yesh Toelet Gidola B'Yibum Ha'ach, that there was something very effective about the brother-in-law being the one who married. V'hu Hara'ui Liyot Kodem Bo, V'acharav HaKarov B'Mishpacha, meaning that he would be the first person to be able to marry this woman, and if not him, someone else who is close to the family, which is basically the way we see it with Ruth, and it's the way we see it with Yehuda, that it's someone in the family. That anyone in the family who could potentially inherit from this person will somehow cause a positive effect. Now, when Kabbalistic scholars read this, or scholars of Kabbalah read this, They say it's very clear that what the Ramban is referring to is that somehow the soul of the deceased transmigrates into the child. That's what it means, that someone from the family should marry the Yevama, someone from the family should marry the widow, because the soul of the deceased will then be in the child. And that will be, you know, sort of a way of carrying on the father's life, literally, through the child. Okay. One more, the Vilna Gaon, someone who you might not expect to see Kabbalah from, but he was a staunch Kabbalist. His Perush on Sefer Yonah, when he talks about, when Yonah says to God, I would rather be dead than alive. So, the Vilna Gaon launches into a discussion of reincarnation. And he says, because he suggests that perhaps Yonah was a reincarnation, that he wanted to be dead again and not to be alive now to be fulfilling his mission of going to Nineveh. How does one know where he erred in a previous incarnation? There are two signs. He stumbles many times in the same area in this incarnation, meaning you have a penchant for whatever it is, talking Lashon Hara, eating non-kosher, whatever it is. That's how you know, oh, that must be what my incarnation is about. He has a great desire for this transgression. He became accustomed to it in the past, and it became part of his nature. Therefore, some people desire one transgression more than another. Right? So here, if you could think of what your vice is, according to the Vilna Gaon, it's because that's whatever you did wrong in your past life. That's the soul that you inherited. So that's good. It's sort of not your fault, but you still have to work past it. So good luck. Right?
I'm
so
doomed.
I don't know if you're doomed or not. I wouldn't worry. So that's what we have so far. If we stopped here, what we would see is, okay, so there were a few people on the fringe, there are a few people who were thinking about this, reincarnation, maybe some of our most prominent Mefarshim were also impacted by it, the Ramban was impacted by it, Rabbi Yosef Karo as a halachist was impacted by it, the Vilna Gaon was impacted by it, but I'm much more interested in seeing how it developed actually as an ideology, because this was not at all an isolated fringe movement at all. In fact, when we talk about, let's say, Chassidism, that develops in the 18th century. Why did Chassidism develop in the 18th century? So some might say, well, the yeshiva movement was so powerful and people wanted to be able to do something that was not just learning Torah. They wanted to be able to just enjoy their happiness, their simcha, and their mitzvot. Another huge reason is because the Chassidim started as Kabbalists and they walked around and they healed people. And they helped people from get out of tough financial situations through using God's name and amulets and things like that. That was the way they attracted followers. They did not attract followers by dancing in the streets. They attracted followers by dancing in the streets, dancing them into their room, and healing their children using God's name, because they were all Kabbalists. And that's why it took off. And one of the things that the Vilna Gaon was very against in terms of Chassidut is not just that they weren't into Talmud Torah, they weren't into Torah learning, but also that they were doing all this weird magic that was using Kabbalah too much in the popular sphere, too much outside of sort of the small inner circles that Kabbalah was supposed to be about. So it's just interesting. Think about Kabbalah exerted a major force starting all the way in the 10th century and literally going to the 18th, 19th, and even today. Again, that brings us back to Madonna and Michael Douglas, maybe. Does he do Kabbalah also? I think so. I don't know if he does Kabbalah. I don't know if any of these people can be said to do Kabbalah. Rabbi Pinto probably does Kabbalah. But these people don't do Kabbalah. Okay. How are we doing so far? Questions? Thoughts? Who's a believer? All right. Great. Good. Give me all your money. Okay. So here's what we're going to do for the next... Oh, good. We have a little time. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to follow the development of Kabbalah. Kabbalah is not a... It's not a single, what can I say? It's not, is that what you say, yoga? Yeah, you don't know too many Kabbalists who do yoga, but they should. They're very similar.
Same thing. You don't really, unless you're really, really into it, you're sort of on the fringe, it's hard to really understand it.
Yeah. I mean, I go to yoga and I still don't understand it. So I don't know about that, but I don't think going to yoga is what we're talking about. I know. Yoga is the first of 8 steps to a spiritual perfection. Now, I am on the half. So I'll get there. So Kabbalah is not a monolithic development at all. This is the way it develops. And I know it's a little bit of a different style shiur that we're giving tonight than we've given the last 3 times, only because I think it's sort of important to talk about the movements as a whole. I think that might be even more important than talking about reincarnation in specific. just to give us a sense of our broader Jewish community and theology. Because there is a whole group out there that just, you know, thinks totally differently from the rest of us. Kabbalah developed as follows. We have suddenly, and we don't know how this happened, we have suddenly in the 12th century a book that was written called Sefer HaBahir, the Book of Illumination. And this book, the way it was styled, is it was a perush on the Torah. Okay? We don't know who wrote it. It was a perush on the Torah, and it said all of these interesting things, sort of mentioned reincarnation, mentioned a lot of things that it seems, at least from what we read in Rav Saadia Gaon's Tshuva, or in Emunot V'Deyot, it seems like some of these things were sort of in the air. But this really became concretized when Moses de Leon wrote the Zohar in the 13th century. Another perush on Chumash, that's the way that it was stylized, as a perush on Chumash, also bringing in Kabbalistic ideas, mystical ideas. And he claimed that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai had written it. Over the next few centuries, people discovered that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai had not written it. However, Kabbalists said, well, even if Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai didn't write it, this is something that has been passed down since the time of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And they point to things like number 8. You look at this Mishnah in Chagiga that says, "Ein dorshin ba'arayot bishlosha." We shouldn't explain or go into the details of illicit sexual relationships with 3 students at a time. V'lo b'maaseh b'reishit b'shnayim. And we shouldn't go through the creation story in depth, in detail, with even 2 people. V'lo b'merkava b'yachid. And not the incident of the chariot, which is Yechezkel's vision of God, with even 1. Ela im kein haya chacham u'mevin midato. Unless that person was wise enough to sort of understand it on their own, and they just need a teacher to take them through the specifics. Now, the Kabbalists, the early Kabbalists in the 12th and 13th centuries, they would pick on statements like this in the Gemara and say, what does this show you? There were small circles of people learning secrets of the Torah that nobody else was privy to. And those were the proto-Kabbalists. Those were the early Kabbalists. And all we're doing is Kabbalah, we've just received it from them. This is a tradition. So the Kabbalists styled themselves as people who were keeping the secrets, you know, almost like the Knights Templar, Lahavdil. They're keeping the secrets of way back when that nobody else knows about. Okay? But what's great about this is that Kabbalah, when you think about Kabbalah, what do you think of? Red string, what else? Sphirot, great. Emanations, divine emanations, great. Most important thing about the first wave of Kabbalah is something called theurgy, when you're trying to impact God by doing certain things, by saying certain things, by doing certain rituals, you're trying to impact God. That was the first wave. And this first wave became very popular, as you might imagine, because again, like what the Hasidim did later, what they did is they walked around and they helped people in their personal lives by reciting God's name, by using amulets, by sitting in a certain way, by bowing in a certain way. That's the way it began. Not as something that had to do with union with God, not as something that had to do with meditation. The idea was to impact the Godhead, whatever that is.
What's the problem with that? In other words, if God responds, right, then that means he's open to it.
Right.
Or she, or whatever. So,
you speak into the microphone? See that again? I like it. Yeah, I once heard President Richard Joel of YU say, use God as a sheep, I think. And then I think he realized he might just use okay, I'm on here. That is a good question. That is a good question. Can you remind me of your name?
That's Andy.
Sorry. Thanks, Andy. So that's a good question. Here's the thing. Before Kabbalah, the way that people try to impact God is they would do mitzvah, right? Meaning they thought that they weren't impacting God as much as they were giving themselves merit so that they deserved whatever it is that they were praying for. Here it's a little bit different because here they're coming up with all of these prostrations, things to say that are not in the Gemara, that are not in anything that we've seen before. They're claiming that they've gotten it from somewhere. But it's hard to know for the other people sitting around, well, where'd you get this from exactly? So that really becomes the difference between are you in or are you out? Do you think that this Kabbalah was really received from Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai? Or do you think this Kabbalah was impacted from, you know, is it based on something else in some way? So that's really, that becomes the controversy, exactly as you say. Some people say, well, obviously it's true, it's working, right? And then other people say, well, you know, illusions, who knows? Okay, everything has a backstory. The next piece was a century later, as it's becoming more, this is all in Spain, by the way, as it's becoming more popularized, it gains new adherents and new ideologues, right? Rabbi Abraham Abu Afia, he suggests, you know what, let's not focus as much on impacting God and making God do things for us. Let's focus on union with God, okay? What, where he was getting this from, whether he was impacted by these people called Cathars, who were Christians who lived around, whether this is something he came up with on his own, whether this is something he got as a tradition, we just will never know, okay? And he didn't suggest where he got it from, okay? And then the last is post getting kicked out of Spain. After the Spanish expulsion in the 16th century, everything changes. You can basically cross all this out, you know, and it's very nice, but you can basically cross all of it out, and what you come to is the whole focus is on tikkun. The whole focus is on fixing the world. The whole focus is on repairing the exile. The way that Rabbi Isaac Luria styles or views the world is he says, basically what happened is God was creating the world, things got out of hand, some of the divine light and sparks got lost, and now they're all over the world and we have to pick them up, we have to rescue them, because God is in exile until we rescue them, and until we bring God out of exile. Which is interesting because he's talking to a generation that was just exiled, that was just expelled from Spain. So a lot of people make a lot of that. But what's most important is that this tikkun, this notion of tikkun, is about self-improvement and is about universal improvement or eschatological, messianic improvement, that everything that we do, every action that we take, could potentially completely transform the world and fix the world and bring the Mashiach. So no longer am I talking about fixing my finances, and I'm not trying to make light, this really was discussed. No longer am I talking about fixing my finances or healing my ill child through theurgy, through saying certain words and hoping that God will respond. No longer am I looking for just personal mystical union, but rather we all become agents in this very powerless generation of being exiled from a place where we've been for hundreds and hundreds of years. We now all become agents at bringing God back to God's place, bringing ourselves back to our place, meaning bringing the Mashiach. It's a very active way to deal with people who are suffering from a serious learned helplessness over the last generation. As much as of an organic development as it is, many people notice that it is a very big brick with the past. Yes, Ron?
In which of these ways is the idea of the Godhead doing things that influence the Godhead itself, in the sense not union with it, but where the Godhead is brought together, or different parts of God are unified?
Right, so the first place that we see...
That's a Kabbalistic notion too, but I don't...
The first place that, yes, because I just want to get to reincarnation, but the first place that we see this notion of the Godhead and Sefirot and different parts of God, and again, this is very superficial because my knowledge of Kabbalah is mostly from the academic perspective. I haven't really, you know, apprenticed with anyone anywhere, checking mezuzahs or anything. Like, I haven't really been in the trenches. But I will tell you from what I have learned, it seems that Sefirot, the first time they came up was the Sefer HaBahir, the very beginning. It was a notion of there are parts of God, whatever that means. And as you might imagine, as Kabbalah develops further, people move away from this notion of parts of God because they viewed it as too pantheistic and too perhaps even polytheistic. So there's a lot of discussion as to what the Sefirot mean, and there's a consolidation. We start with 10, and then other people say, well, maybe we can really consolidate it into 3. They're trying to move it together. Okay, so by the time you get to Lurianic Kabbalah, we're not focused on that too much, except for on Shabbos, when the Lechadodi, mystical union between the Kala and the Chatan, is really the mystical union between the feminine part of God and the masculine part of God, which is another for another time. Okay, so development of reincarnation. Let's just read the Zohar in the italics. So this is 13th century. Truly all souls must undergo transmigration, but men do not perceive the ways of the Holy One, meaning we don't know about it. How the revolving scale is set up and men are judged every time, every day at all times, and how they are brought up before the tribunal, both before they enter into this world and after they leave it. They perceive not the many transmigrations and the many mysterious works which the Holy One accomplished. Meaning, don't mock it just because you don't see it. Right? You can't necessarily see it. And of course, something that's very significant about Kabbalah is that they will look back into the Gemara and reinterpret what the Gemara says, or perhaps interpret for the right, you know, properly for the first time what the Gemara says as being part of their philosophy. For example, in number 10, Amar Rabbi Abahu, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Talmidei Chachamim, Ein Or Shel Gehinom, Sholetet Bahem. A Talmid Chacham is not going to be hurt by the fires of hell. So what do the Kabbalists do with that? They say, well, that means that he's not going to be punished in hell. He'll come back, he'll be reincarnated, he'll be punished down here, and then he'll go back up. Which, when you read that in Chagiga, you wouldn't necessarily have thought that. But they say, well, clearly if the fires of hell are not having an impact, there must be something that is going to cleanse this person. So now let's go straight into it. At the very beginning, reincarnation, the suggestion was that it could only be into a human body. You look in the Zohar, reincarnation is only into a human body. It's only later that reincarnation into animals, plants, inanimate objects comes. And there's actually a very significant difference between these two types of reincarnation. Okay? We're getting now to the very meat of it. Number 11. Human reincarnation. This is how it works, and this is where there's going to be the greatest traction in terms of the comparison between Kabbalah and Hinduism, which is we're trying to figure out who are we? Who am I? What am I? Am I a body? Am I a soul? Am I a mind? What am I? And reincarnation taps into that question. The part of the soul that one personally elevates, that which he or she was especially connected to in his or her lifetime, never reincarnates. It is your soul. It is the real you, meaning it cannot go into another person or anything. The other parts of the soul, those which were not elevated in the individual's lifetime, has no real connection with the individual. For example, an individual is considered kind, a kind and loving person, a person of chesed and charity, is connected to, and therefore elevates the part of the soul which corresponds to the mitzvah of charity. It is this part of the soul, the part that was his or her distinct part, the me of the soul that goes to Gan Eden, and it is with this portion of the soul that he or she will be resurrected. So reincarnation, according to Kabbalistic tradition, what it does is it separates the me from everything else. So whatever the me is, whatever it is that I would characterize myself as, that's who I am, and I stay in Gan Eden, or I stay wherever I belong, and the other parts of me are what go, perhaps, into other people. Okay? Reincarnation into animal, vegetable, inanimate. Very different. It's quite the opposite. In this type of reincarnation, the you of the soul, the part of the soul that one has elevated and associated with, is the same part that now reincarnates. Through this incarnation, the soul will receive its fitting punishment. The punished soul does not animate the being, it merely resides within it and suffers. It can't animate the being because it's you. It can't be anything else. And what the Kabbalists point to are psukim, like where David HaMelech says, Hatzila micherev nafshi, miyad kelev yechidati, save me from the sword, save me from the dog. Say Kabbalists, save me from being reincarnated into a dog. And this is one of many, many, many examples. Part of Kabbalah is, the concept is to put themselves back into the tradition. To say, this has always been here, you just didn't know what it meant, because it was in private circles. That was the whole idea. The one thing that Lurianic Kabbalah adds here, is it says, well, what does it mean that you have to be reincarnated? What it means is that your soul still requires tikkun. Why does your soul require tikkun? Because when Adam Harishon, when Adam ate from the Eitz Hadaat, ate from the tree, sparks from him went everywhere. Those sparks are within us. So those sparks need to be elevated, and he says there are 613, shocker, 613 bodily locations where these sparks can be. Every part, every location there has to be completely elevated because we're making up for Adam HaRishon. Again, tikkun, very different from the stuff we're seeing before. And every part of that body, until it's elevated, the soul that corresponds will go back. It will keep being reincarnated, die again, reincarnated, die again. That's what he adds. What I'd like to do more than anything, actually, is I'd like to read a little bit about how this works for a second. Everybody's with me so far. It's very clear that there's a development. We're going from reincarnated into humans to reincarnated even into other things. The truth is there's more of a development originally. This is very similar to what we talked about in terms of confession, actually. Originally, they thought you were reincarnated only for sexual sins. After that, they started thinking, no, you reincarnated for any sin that you've done that you may have to get away with. Part of reincarnation, the notion is to try to separate between what the real you is and everything else, and that's a distinctive part of this philosophy. Reincarnation is not just about punishment and death and things like that. It's also a psychological, it's sort of a psychological read on and a philosophical read on who the person is. It defines you in your life as much as it defines a person in their death. It appeals to people who try to figure out, well, why do I have certain proclivities? You have those proclivities because that's the soul that you have inherited from this, that, and the other. It's not really you. It's something you've inherited. You can get over it. So it's quite interesting the way that this fits in, not just to life and death, not just to gemul, not just to reward and punishment, but it's really a whole way of looking at the human being. And Luriana Kabbalah, with its tikkun, adds something that seems quite akin to original sin, but obviously saying that is a very loaded thing. So I would say it's a Kabbalistic version of the impact of the origins of the world, both in terms of sparks moving everywhere when God created the world, and in terms of sparks moving everywhere when Adam HaRishon sinned. But either way, what happened at the beginning still impacts us today, according to Rabbi Isaac Luria. Shar HaGilgulim, a Lurianic Kabbalist, Rav Chaim Vital, and with this we're going to end our study of Kabbalistic reincarnation. I just think this is so amazing and precious. It says, HaMedaber Lashon Hara, he's going to give you the punishment, the reincarnation. He's going to explain to you how it works. HaMedaber Lashon Hara V'Kayotzei Bo, a person who speaks evil about someone and anything like that, Mitgalgel Be'Evin Domi. That person comes back as a stone, as an inanimate stone. Ki Tmurat HaDibur Hu Domi. Right? Because in exchange for his decision to speak too much, now he doesn't speak. Okay, so he sits there. Hama'achil nevelot, and this one's a play on words, Li Yisrael. Someone who feeds a nevela, someone who feeds something non-kosher, we'll say for our needs, to someone who is Jewish. Mitgalgel be'aleh ha'ilan. That person is going to become a leaf of a tree. Why? Because mitgalgel be'aleh ha'novelet la'aret. Nivela novelet. They're going to be reincarnated as something that withers on the ground. That's going to fall off the tree and wither on the ground. And this, I think, is the most vivid one. Misha shofech damim, someone who spills blood, who murders, mitgalgel b'mayim. That person is going to be reincarnated as water or in water. Unclear. V'simanech, and here is the mnemonic to remember that, al ha'aretz tishpechenu kamayim. The Torah says that when we shecht an animal, we should put its blood on the ground. When we're shechting it as a korban, we do something called kisui hadam. We cover over the blood instead of just letting it flow. Al ha'aretz tishpechenu kamayim. You put it on the floor and then you cover it with dirt with your foot. Ve'anshohu, and this is the guy's punishment. This is why he's water and what it's going to do. She'omei b'kiluach hamayim. He's going to be standing in the way of a flow of water, a spritch, I like to call it, of water. V'sham hamayim niklachim alav tamid. And the water is constantly going to be flowing in his direction. V'hu rotzeh lakum v'lamod. This guy's going to want to stand up. But the water keeps knocking him down. This is the Sisyphus of Kabbalah, right? He keeps going up the mountain with the boulder and then he keeps knocking him down. So this guy, he spilled blood, so he's going to come back as a liquid, as water, and he's waiting here. As you can see, This is an ideology. Books and books and books written. Students and teachers, entire communities believing in this. Centuries and centuries. So when we say, what is the Jewish view of reincarnation? There are Jewish views of reincarnation. There are a number, and these things still survive today. This is not something that stopped in the 16th century. It still goes on today. There are still people who believe this today. Now that we have at least a superficial handle on what Kabbalah has to say, or what Jews have to say about reincarnation in general, contrast it with the Hindu perspective in the 3 seconds we have left. So the Hindu perspective is also very cyclical. The notion is very cyclical, the same way the original Greek notion was. Something called samsara, which is the cycle of the world constantly reinvents itself. But I want to read something from the Upanishads, which is on the last page, on page 4. The way that Hinduism developed, Hinduism is not a proper term. Hinduism is a term that was made up by colonialists to try to account for the different rituals and the different practices that Indians had. But there really was no one Hinduism. So there are a lot of different Hinduisms, actually. But they're all based originally on the Vedas, which is their original scripture from the second millennium before the Common Era, and on the Upanishads, which is from the first millennium before the Common Era. So I just want to read from the Upanishads, because that's the first place that that reincarnation comes up. As a goldsmith forms newer and fairer form from a rough nugget, so the soul fashions for itself another newer, fairer form, meaning it goes into a new body, constantly going up in level. He is reborn here either as a worm or as a butterfly or as a fish or as a bird or as a lion or as a serpent or as a tiger or as a person or as some other being in this or that condition, according to his works, according to his knowledge. And those last words, according to his knowledge, are going to be the most significant. And with that, we'll look at number 15 to give us a basic sense. There's obviously a lot to do in terms of this, but I just wanted to give a basic idea. According to Hinduism, why is it that people are being reincarnated? So according to Judaism, according to Kabbalah, we have seen that the reason why people are being reincarnated is because they have to do certain mitzvot, right? The me that does chesed, but what about the part that's not me that should be doing X, Y, and Z? So I'll come back and I'll do something else. Or the sparks that fell from Adam HaRishon, and I'm trying to get them back. But the idea is that it's very much through behavior and belief. In Hinduism, that's not what it's about at all. The only way in which behavior impacts is what you come back as. But in terms of what the charge is, what the person is supposed to be doing, it's all about knowledge. It's not about behavior. It's not about doing good deeds. It's about knowledge. It's about understanding. Very, very, very different. So here it is. Hindus believe that the individual is composed of the physical, the gross body, meaning physical body, the subtle body, which is what connects the body to the soul, and the soul. When a person dies, it is only the first that perishes. The last two entities take rebirth. A person with a good record of actions, meaning good karma, in his or her previous births, takes rebirth in a handsome body, in a rich or a noble household. A person with too many bad actions in his or her record is born as an insect, a plant. This cycle of birth and death continues indefinitely till the individual attains salvation. In the state of salvation, only the soul survives in blissful communion with God, the universal soul. Good actions and right belief are not sufficient for obtaining salvation. These merely make a person fit to embark upon the path of realization of spiritual truths. The notion, and this is a difficult one to pin down if we're not in a sort of a Hindu environment, knowing from the inside out the ideology, but the notion is that a person gains knowledge throughout their reincarnations. And they continually are reincarnated as something a little bit higher than what they were before because they're supposed to gain knowledge at that level. And so finally they reach blissful communion with God where they don't need a body at all. So certainly what this has in common with Kabbalah, of course, Lahavdil, but what this has in common with Kabbalah is that what we're looking at is an opposition between the body and the soul. What we're looking at is trying to figure out, well, what's the real me and what's the part that needs to be fixed in order to become the real me? That's a very serious comparison. between these two. And I think it's absolutely fascinating. And when people discuss, Rabbi Arya Kaplan actually discussed this in his book on meditation, tries to figure out how did this happen, that they ended up with the same ideas. And his suggestion is that when Avraham married Keturah, who was his Pilegesh, his concubine, that her kids took some of this knowledge, meaning he's going all the way back to Abraham, took some of this knowledge with them to the Far East. You can come up with all sorts of different perspectives, but let me just tell you a quick story. There I was in my first year in graduate school, and I was telling, I don't know why, I was talking to my professor, for some reason I was telling him a Hasidic story, which I'm sure people have heard, about the guy who says his house is too full, it's too crowded, and the guy says, the rabbi says to him, so bring in animals, and bring in this, and bring that. He says, now it's really crowded, he says, take some of them out. And he says, oh, it's so much better now. He takes all them out. It's so much better now. And he appreciates what he has. And I said, yeah, that's a Hasidic story. And the two Buddhist nuns who were in the class with me said, that's not a Hasidic story. That's a Buddhist story. And they said, and it's with a duck. He put ducks in his house. I said, I don't know. You might have one up on me. You're the second millennium before the Common Era, and we're the second millennium after the Common Era on this. So I don't know where all of this came from. But suffice it to say, there are serious similarities. But the most important, and with this I'm actually going to finish, and you can read the Buddhist thing on your own. It's a slight variation. With this I'm actually going to finish that the major distinction between transmigration or reincarnation in Jewish thought and transmigration in Far Eastern thought is the question of what our goal is in this, in our travels. That according to Jewish thought, the goal is behavioral, the goal is belief-oriented, and according to Vedic thought, according to Far Eastern thought, the goal is knowledge or spiritual truth. Very different. The assumption is that, the Jewish assumption is that we can get spiritual truth in this life right now. We don't have to keep going through life. We can do that in one lifetime. And for that reason, I'm going to end, with your permission, I'm going to end with this very last one, Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, and with this, I really think you can take this with you on Yom Kippur and read it. It's just amazing. He is a Lurianic Kabbalist, and he says, Hatshuva tashlim kol pagav. Tshuva can make up for any flaw, the iftor kol gilgul, and it can exempt you from ever having to be reincarnated. This isn't a book that is about what God looks like. This is a book that is not modern Orthodox. He says, tshuva is instead of gilgul. Ki hatshuva ki shinui Hashem. Shinui makom, shinui maseh. Because what tshuva is about is changing one's name, changing one's place, changing one's actions. Ki inyan ha-gilgul mamash, just like reincarnation. Sheyesh bo shloshtam, that has all three. Lazeh yashuv b'tshuva, and for this reason a person should do teshuva, v'yishaneh atzmo mimkomo, and should move themselves from where they are, meaning ela yeshev et anavim b'shiflut v'anava, meaning move their souls to where they should be. They should sit in humility with people. Shinui maaseh, change their actions. Ad ata, until now, haya machiseh kono, this person angered God. Ve'ata hu misameach lekono, and now he gladdens God. B'torato, with this person's, with his or her Torah learning, uv'maaseh atovim, or with his or her good deeds. Shinui Hashem, a change of name, it's a change of identity. Ad ata, until now, ge'eh, this person was a proud, arrogant person. Ata anav, now this person is humble. Adata machis, until now this person was a person who angered people. Ata misameach, and now he's a person, or she's a person who gladdens people. Shehu mishtane mishem ra l'shem tov, this person is changing from a bad name to a good name. Mi michalel l'mikadesh, from one who profanes to one who sanctifies. V'lazeh ein tzarich gilgul, because, and for this reason, this person doesn't need reincarnation. This person is better than someone who's been reincarnated. Because only the soul is reincarnated. And this person, when he or she has an opportunity, fixes their soul and their body. Much better not to have to rely on this esoteric, Kabbalistic stuff, but to realize that what they're trying to do, the whole thing is about reforming behavior. And that's kind of a way through the black back door, looking at the mystics among us, that we really, when it comes to Yamin Noraim, we really all have the same goals in mind. Regardless of what our regular dogma is, we really all have the same goals in mind. And that is, to whatever degree we can, Shinui Makom, in a symbolic way, Shinui Ma'aseh, in a very real way, and Shinui Hashem, in a way of identifying with something positive. So thank you all for coming, and I think that Rabbi Morris has a pitch, but I don't know where he is. Rabbi Morris, are you here? Oh, he has a pitch. But thank you all for coming, and of course my email address is down here. I'll get the pad, but always feel free. And hopefully I'll be giving a series on response to biblical criticism in November. So look out for that, if you're interested.
First of all, too, I thank all of you so much for coming the past month. It's been wonderful to see all of you, some new faces, and some faces we've gotten used to as well. I want to just take this opportunity. You've heard a lot over the past month about the Tanakh course that we're going to be running at the end of October. You can sign up during all of October, but I want to encourage you, if you're thinking about doing it or you're planning on taking it, you might as well sign up tonight. There's an early registration fee that goes through the end of September. So I'm here. If anyone has any questions about the course, I'm happy to answer. It's a fantastic course. You can learn a ton. We've got great scholars and well-known people who are participating in teaching the classes. Ilana has been teaching a bunch of the classes.
Who are some of the scholars working?
Rabbi Menachem Mutab, Rabbi Chaim Angel, Rachel Friedman from Drusha, among other great people. So it's really a great opportunity. I encourage everyone to think about it. The yellow paper is the Tanakh course. The blue one is another course that we're starting, Sfarim Bashana, together with Dr. Shifley from NYU. If anyone has any questions, feel free to speak to me now or give me a call. You can sign up now if you like or on our website.
Thanks for coming. I actually had it added. I don't know if it's on here, but I had it in the public. Yeah, it doesn't matter if you know what I'm doing. Thanks for coming. That's a lot.
The rabbi started to the farm. Yeah. He's talking to the farmer, and they're trying to negotiate the freedom of this forest. Do you know the story? They're trying to negotiate the freedom of this forest. The farmer says, "This is my best course. You can't negotiate the freedom of the forest." The rabbi is looking at the freedom of the forest.
I'm sitting right up on the